Good. So we left at number seven in the breach of authority and jurisdiction. And we addressed the collecting of garnishments. And then and proceeding unfound in liens and levies. And under footnote 131, we reiterated the previous case that the state is without power to impose either an income tax or occupation tax for state purposes. Well, if the state is without power to impose either an income tax or occupation tax, and if the Congress and federal government or national government does not have any power within the states, obviously any liens and levies coming from the same source, from under their jurisdiction or authority, are without power within the state. So therefore, liens and levies are worthless. Try to convince them of that. And that's where we go into court, and that's where that's next stage. And after we get a judgment in court, which Bill was mentioning, we move on to stage three, which is enforcement and getting the money from the little guy or the big guy, whoever ends up being the responsible party. Item 8, under breach of duties, by misrepresenting their authority with full knowledge of the correct facts, such as to induce me to enter into agreements which I would not enter if agents disclosed all facts. And this is another exhibit pointing at the fact that we asked questions if this is a contract, this represents a contract which justifies their actions, justifies their letters, and they did not respond. So that's a misrepresentation of authority because they're acting again without jurisdiction, without proof of jurisdiction on the record. And we already addressed the case where jurisdiction administrative agencies have to have proof of jurisdiction on the record in the administrative proceedings at all times. I'm sorry? Can you again? I have a noise back here. I couldn't hear what you were saying. Right. No. No. Those are. That's where exhibits will go, in your notice. Those are. Okay. We'll go over the details there. Again, whatever questions you have, I'll address. I just want to keep this flow because it gets tiresome if we go back and forth. And if we lose, I've noticed in past presentations, if we lose where we are, it's a little harder to get back to it and it's more tiresome. We're almost there, almost there. You've been very good. The moral, public, and private laws have inherent limitations in their authority and cannot be construed as a license for agents to cause injury. Okay, what are those moral, public, and private laws? The authority of legislation in the state government is not unlimited. There are several limitations to their legislative. Remember, we said this before. It's the same Acolo. But we bring it now under this breach of duty. This is why we cited it at first, made them aware, and this is where it applies. That's why it applies. Have inherent limitations in their authority and cannot be construed as a license for agents to cause injury. And here's a list, see Bill of Rights, 18 U.S.C. These we suggest being used, but where it says exhibit of all cited, this will be one page, almost like what you see in the court of record law of the case. So these would all be cited, like I did 18 U.S.C. earlier, 241 and 242. But they would all be, for convenience, all on 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 pages, whatever, separate from the document, okay, as an exhibit of these citations. Now, this is something that we all understood, and I'm sure a lot of people understood, but I found that a lot of people there's something that they don't understand when it comes to damages. We understand injuries being that which is inflicted upon us, and we understand the damages is that which we collect payment for, or based on the damages. However, Bill suggested special damages. Yes.
Fourth line, when agents should not so done, should not have should not so done, or should not have done so.
Should not have so done.
Okay, I'll take it.
Yeah. We can go the other way. You're going to have the Word document you do with as you please.
That's incorrect as it stands.
We'll get there and we'll stand corrected.
Okay.
Not a problem. I wanted to address something here. Let me read this. Yeah. Because agents have demonstrated that agents have no intention to return my overwithheld sums, those people that filed 4852s, exhibit so-and-so. You get a letter saying, well, because you owe this and from past years and all this frivolous, you're claiming this return, we're going to hold this in exchange for what you already owe us. One of those kind of situations.
Yeah.
Because agents have no right of ownership interest over said sums. Because agents reached outside the scope of agents' lawful authority and acted under color of office and color of law when agents should not have so done. Should have not done so. All right.
Yes.
Here,
not the have,
what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you all the freedom. So whatever is highlighted, you do with as you please. And we'll do that. Because agents have extorted and threatened to keep extorting. Now, therefore, agents are liable for the following damages for the injuries suffered by Ima Hart. Special damages, $100,000, and general damages. Now, this red here, you'll take out, obviously, after you figure out what it says. The issue was, I did not understand originally what special damages, that there was a difference between special damage and general damages. But apparently, you can charge general damages, and Bill addressed this a little bit earlier, equal to the amount of the special damages. So the total that you end up here that we discussed earlier, remember all those charges that we had here under injuries? So you draw up a total, let's say that comes to $100,000. Okay? Well, right here, under damages, that's the $100,000 under those injuries. And now, you add as a general damages, because you had to go through those damages, the same amount. And apparently that is the way it goes. Now, a little brief detail of what we have done in 1, 2, 3 notices and demand. In some of those, I think it's second and third, we put a provision. We're saying, look, if you do not respond and whatever, you may open yourself to punitive damages up to 5 times. I'm not showing any picture, but thank you. You may open yourself to punitive damages up to 5 times. And if you do not respond to this, I may choose to go pursue that remedy. And you will have no say-so in any court in California. And we also addressed court of record. We also said common law or any court I may choose to go to. And if you acquiesce, well, then it'll be too late for you to say anything. Sure enough, we do what the gentleman was talking about, negative environment. Well, we call it notice and demand, notice of default, opportunity to cure, and the final default. And we go through that procedure. Those are the three. But within these, there are all these other little notices in time. So the notice and demand one, it includes those three little steps within it. Then you have notice and demand two, notice and demand three. Sometimes it's not necessary. And if depending on what their responses are, we can jump directly to four, which then would become three, depending on which level, how complex it gets. So that's why I wanted to discuss a little bit about these special damages, general damages. And if you end up in court and they demur, if they admit to the facts, basically that's a demur, then you can move directly to judgment, and you'll learn that in the court procedures. I don't go in details at this point. Oh, that's not tied into the PA.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite a steep old process. It was first filed the affidavit, and then we came.
This is a $500 device. $800 device.
Well, I've done several things wrong. My whole idea of a server has been wrong because I didn't get a regular process server or just interested parties square that it was server. In fact, that judge, you and I were, when I was facing music, he said the very same thing. Well, said, you didn't serve it. Where's your certification?
Testing.
Testing.
In collusion under color of batteries. Thank you very much. No, no, these are pretending to be energizers. Okay. Action. All right, so where was I?
You were talking about
special damages.
Default and notice to cure and all that good stuff.
Where was it?
First problem, second problem.
Okay. All right. So I heard three different propositions here. Let me see. Same as special damages. Okay. So where we said the punitive damages, if you're in a court and you already made them aware of that and they demurred and you go to the judgment, which is a breeze, let's say, in a court, if that were the circumstances, you can basically say, since you're going to be the judge and passing the judgment, you can say, okay, I see that you were warned on such and such day that you basically defaulted on this claim of five times damages. You kind of looks like you agreed to it. So based on this, the court thereby orders five times special damages or whatever, punitive damages. I'm sorry. That has not been tried. I don't know if Bill has ever experienced that, but we have that in our notice and demand as it stands right now for this particular case. All right? So, demand. Therefore, I demand that within 21 days, and there's no reason for 21 days, but we think 3 weeks is fine, from the date of service of this notice and demand. So that's important, from the date of service. Don't change that if you get creative, because it has to be fair, has to appear fair. Agents provide all the facts and proof as referenced in the above paragraphs, A through G, or show good cause if more time is needing. And please, whatever you do, keep that, because that is legal language. The elements I request are prerequisite for proper diligent discharge of agent's lawful and moral functions under oath and public contract, which we addressed previously, oath and public contract. However, the elements I request fall under the same Supreme Court, 1950. It is not the function of our government to keep the citizen from falling into error. It is the function of the citizen to keep the government from falling into error. So I'm just doing my job, aren't I? This is my function. I'm going to take it seriously. I'm going to get a few friends of mine to help with this, and we're going to follow through, holding hands.
Although you're not a citizen, you're a people.
That doesn't matter. To them, I'm a citizen, right? To them, if I am a citizen, they should listen to this. So they take the position that because I'm a citizen, they can decide what to do, tell me, what not to tell me, keep me from falling into error. No, that's not the way it's said. It's not the function of our government to keep a citizen from falling into error. It is the function of the citizen to keep the government from falling into error. So them denying me that which is my function doesn't fall within their purview, doesn't fall within their authority. That's how I interpret that.
Yeah.
Any suggestions? How can we interpret that otherwise? Okay, thank you. And we're in agreement. Number two, demand. Names of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 agents. Those are all the names of the agents in the beginning on this notice and demand, whoever you have, and their respective agencies, Sacramento, Santa Ana, you name it. And each of them, within 60 days of service of this notice and demand, in good faith, do their duty and pay the damages suffered by me at their hands, or within 21 days from the service of this notice and demand, show cause why said demand should not be enforced in a court of record in California. And this is the formulation that is already on site in Bill's notice and demand example. So we worded it in such a way to address the court of record. And I like the California because where the officer's powers are limited by statute, his actions beyond those limitations are considered individual and not sovereign actions. The officer is not doing the business which the sovereign has empowered him to do, or he is doing it. Yes, thank you. He is doing it in a way which the sovereign has forbidden. Now, obviously, they're going to claim the sovereign is the state, aren't they? Good. We'll get there. His actions are ultra vires or virus. His authority, and therefore, may be made the object of specific relief. It is important to note, page 690, that in such cases, the relief can be granted without impleading the sovereign, only because of the officer's lack of delegated power. A claim of error in the exercise of that power is therefore not sufficient. That was, if the gentleman had waited, we would have already answered this as far as why we're going after the little guy. A claim of error in the exercise of that power is therefore not sufficient. The respondent's contention, which the Court of Appeal sustained, was that there exists a third category of cases in which the action of a government official may be restrained or directed. If, says the respondent, an officer of the government wrongly takes or holds specific property to which the plaintiff has title, then his taking or holding is a tort and illegal as a matter of general law, whether or not it be within his delegated powers. Whether or not be within his delegated powers. Now, who triggered this? Who wrote you the first letter? That little guy. So that's where they would recognize that you're going after the correct remedy rather than jumping horses and going to the highest authority. I hope that answers your question. All right. So it's a little bit more logical that way, and it's easier to handle again. So he may therefore be sued individually, right there, to prevent the illegal taking or to recover the property illegally held. You notice that none of these cases thus far said the corporation or the state institution or the agency may be sued. So I figured, well, why not go for those who we can, because we have support in cases, that's Supreme Court. So I have the support, an agreement of the Supreme Court. They're supposed to abide by Supreme Court decisions, not me. I'm using this, I'm showing, putting it in their face. Here it is. Take a good look at it, and you choose beyond this what you're going to do. Larson v. Domestic Foreign Commerce Corporation, 337 U.S. 680, whatever. Good. So moving on. Three. Agents notify me. These are we're now, just to refresh, under demand, okay? Therefore, one, two, three. Agents notify me in writing of the specific elements creating a presumption of liability and the valid forms and information so that I can make the corrections to erroneous returns filed by third parties in regards to me and avoid exposure to any further harassment by agents. I had a question here, and I hope this will answer. The question was, okay, in the notice and demand, how do you know when the IRS FTB, or how will the IRS FTB gives up, what do they say to answer and whatever? So we're going to address that. In other words, how do you know whether they gave up, and do they send you any proof to that extent? So this is addressed in point four. Agents notify me in writing that the FDB account in regards to me is closed. Yes, we have a question. We need a microphone. Or something, some irregularity is happening.
Thank you. Number three, can you go
number up? Number three, yes.
You're talking about agents notify me in writing of the specific element.
Element or elements.
Okay.
If there's only one, could be only one.
No,
hey,
okay.
We only have one.
Could be the second line. You're talking about the correction to erroneous returns. You're talking about information returns?
Any return. We don't want to be specific. We don't know their
details. Well, you're not
talking
about tax returns.
Okay. We're talking about money returns. Any erroneous returns. Not only information. I'm talking about, for example, when in the IRS case, in this case, 2 years in a row, there were some returns. Were those erroneous? We want information about that. We also want whatever is a...
But you're saying third parties. Are those third parties making returns for you?
Oh, I see what you're asking. No, I did not understand.
I'm sorry.
Let's
yeah.
see.
Erroneous
I can
information
make
returns or information statements, income statements. The information returns are the W-2s, 1099s, 1098s.
Good point. Okay. Information returns then.
And then income
yes,
statements are the forms 940, 941 that the companies file on payroll returns. Is that what you... So you could say information returns?
Well, I would like to say any information returns. Let them be specific. We're trying to drag information from them. What is it? Thus far, they haven't claimed any particular thing.
But you're talking about third parties.
Yes, but we don't know what third parties sent, do we?
Yeah, you do. You get the transcript, the IRS transcript, and it tells you.
So basically, you're suggesting that... okay, so this is one approach. By the way, this is another approach. What Linda's suggesting is that you can look at what they are asking and abide by what they are asking and follow their procedures to get your information. Am I making sense? Am I saying what you're saying?
No.
That's what I'm understanding.
Okay, I guess I'm just trying to clarify. You want to find out what you need to make corrections to erroneous returns filed by third parties. Now, the only kind of returns that I can think of that would be filed by third parties would either if you get an accountant or CPA to file your tax return.
Do those qualify as information returns?
Other information returns are the W-2s or 1099s
Great.
That you get at the end.
Right.
Or the income statements, which the companies complete, which are the payroll returns, Form 940, 941, showing taxes withheld.
Can we group those in one term, general term, that
well,
is
no,
not
specific? Well, no, because they do best, I mean, they are very
What would you
specific.
Suggest we call them? Erroneous information returns or?
I would think you would ask for two. Because
okay.
are
so
they
one
coming
would be information?
Right. Information returns
right.
or income statements?
When you wonder all tax class 5 estate and gift tax forms, according to their 6209 manual, they have
yes.
nothing to do with income tax whatsoever.
So you're calling those information returns
and? Income.
Information returns and income statements.
Because actually when they start attacking you, it's because they've received one or more of those.
And that's what you're trying to figure out what to correct.
No objection. Wonderful. Thank you very much. We look forward to further input from anybody that has information that can help us all. All right.
Mark?
Yes, sir.
I think what you're talking about is 1099s there.
Basically, whatever the third parties are sending.
Right.
And we start from the premise that, look, why are you bothering me? Oh, well, because I have something. Okay, send me whatever. Send me whatever erroneous returns you received from third parties or erroneous information, which Linda pointed out, erroneous information returns and income statements. But I'm presuming that they're receiving income statements. Until they send those to us, we don't know what they have. We haven't been able to we asked. I understand that, but I don't want to. I'm lazy. And if I don't owe them any allegiance, and I don't have to do anything, I don't want to dance to the tune of their sandbox because, again, I understand what you're saying, but when I accept their proposition that, hey, well, in order for you to comply with this, you need to read in this book, and then I go this circular logic. If I don't have to. Good example, I don't usually tell stories, but I think this is pretty relevant. A good example was given to me by somebody when we were going to Nevada Common Law Court. And the gentleman said, okay, imagine you're outside in the Walmart parking lot, and your friend works there, and you guys are there for a beer or a cigarette break, and out comes the manager from the Walmart, and he works for Walmart, you don't work for Walmart, and he screams bloody murder, you guys get your ass back in there, or else you're fired. Which one of you is going to go? Are you going to follow your friend in there? No. Why? Because you know that does not apply to you. So I am trying to look at this whole picture with the notice and demand. This is my personal preference. You do it as you please. Through a very narrow scope. Look, if I don't belong behind that door, who are you to ask me to do all these things? If I don't acknowledge your jurisdiction, all your procedures, anything, I'm just doing you the courtesy, because I'm a nice guy, to respond to those, because not only the courtesy, but they seem a little threatening, that last paragraph, you know? So maybe there's something I don't know. Maybe I stepped in your sandbox and I wasn't aware of it, and now I left this little trail behind me. But I need to be made aware of that, and the civil code tells me that I'm in charge here. I'm supposed to keep an eye on you. I can ask you for information, and if you don't give it to me, well, you're kind of acting in bad faith. And I kind of try to keep it on that morality issue in case we're facing a jury. So the jury doesn't now have to go through tens of documents of detailed administrative little minutiae. And this is how I'm trying to avoid having to go behind that door. That's the approach. That's a strategy. And again, yes, sir. Yeah, absolutely. Here.
Raise your hand.
Yes.
I think that in addition to everything that Mark said, there's a strategy here that you do not want to be the attorney for the other side. Okay? You don't force them to do the right thing. They are going to screw up. They're going to make their mistakes. The biggest mistake being that they're assumptive and they don't want to do their research because they're lazy too. But there's a very universal principle, which is that when somebody wants to take jurisdiction over somebody else, and when that jurisdiction is challenged, the burden is on the initiator to prove that he has jurisdiction. So when you're telling them, you're sending this notice and demand, it's true you saw a lot of case law here, but all of the case law we have here, it can be lumped into one category, and that is you don't have jurisdiction. And I don't see how you got jurisdiction. And I make absolutely no effort to guide them into coming up with the right answer. So maybe you know about a file that might explain it, but I wouldn't ask them to show me the file because maybe they won't show it. And if they don't, they lose, even if they have it. So the strategy is put up a wall to stop them. Don't make them do the right thing. You know, I've seen people go into court and demand that the criminal court be a court of record. And I'm saying, no, you don't want that, because when they make a decision, it's not appealable. You know? Don't make them do the right thing. Don't make them obey the Constitution. Let them make their error. And once they've made the full commitment to whatever their strategy is, they can't back down. They, you know, when you reach judgment, they can't come back later and say, oh, we forgot to mention something. Okay? Does that make sense what I'm saying? So, yeah. Let them die on their own errors. Or what do they say? Let them fall on their own swords. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
What were you saying?
You learned so well.
Is that a signature line under number 3 there?
Under number 3, is that a signature line?
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yes.
I don't remember a signature line. It's oh, this? No, no, is
no,
this
no, no,
the
no,
separation?
No, no, on pages.
Oh, I'm sorry, sorry. I went too far. Far?
By.
I went too far.
No.
No. More? Keep going. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the line above the footnotes. For some reason, it didn't go all the way. No. No, we're almost there. This is 16 on 17, see? Right there. It's automatic. That line, yes. Thank you, John. It's automatically inserted by the computer. Right. So this is the fourth item there. Under demand. Agents notify me in writing that the FDB account in regards to me is closed and no deficiency exists for the year so and so and so. So this should answer what the gentleman asked here. That's how we would know. And if they don't do it, well, let's see what happens. And then no agents, FDB personnel, or anyone acting in concert with them shall engage in any further collection or any acts of harassment against me. Now, let's say this gets kicked upstairs, and somebody looks at it and they say, you know what, these guys don't got any game. Where did we pick up last time? Oh, from their employer. Okay, issue an EWOT. Let's see what they do. EWOT, earnings withholding order for taxes. That is a garnishment order from IRS or FTB issues to the employer, the private employer. And the employer turns over the money, 25% or whatever. So let's say they do that, right? Which means, obviously, they did not comply with item 4 or 5 or our demand. At which point, this is the default. If all these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are not provided, if agents do not answer within the 21 days, any and all uncontradicted statements. Remember I had you circle uncontradicted on your file there, FTB file, where he is back at you, Bubba. Any and all uncontradicted statements. If the evidence is clear, positive, uncontradicted, and of such a nature that it cannot rationally be disbelieved, the court must instruct that a fact so proved has been established as a matter of law. And that's what we use in our judgment. Because remember, if they do not come back with a response to this, we can consider this contradicted, and that's an automatic demur in court. Okay, and based on that, we move directly to judgment. We don't even have to go through a trial. Okay? So, if agents do not answer within the 21 days, any and all uncontradicted statements, presumptions, and enclosures herein, exhibits 1 through 100, shall become acquiesced as fact in the record, and agents' non-responsive replies or collection attempts may be construed as willful. And I had you circle that willful. I mean, not circle. Keep in mind the willful when I presented the Supreme Court case. Willful is a very powerful tool that opens the door to punitive damages. Okay? So, as in fact, in the record, California Civil Code Section 3516, acquiescence in error takes away the right of objecting to it. So, even if they say, oh, oops, we didn't see that, well, sorry, and that'll be in the hand of the judge, whoever that ends up being, and we know who the judge is in the court of record, don't we? If agents fail to satisfy the demand within the allotted time, after having been duly served with this notice and demand, Then by tacit procuration, remember Bill pointing that out and explained what that means. Okay, I'm a her nominee and her assigns will determine for agents the facts, the duties, and the damages owed by agents. Further, if agents fail to satisfy the demand, then Ima Hurt may take lawful action in a court of record, in personam and in rem, to defend against agents and persons acting in concert with agents who have caused any injuries to Ima Hurt. Why? To beat them up? No. To secure her substantive rights. Remember, we're not threatening. And redeem the aforementioned damages owed to her. We are defending. And the only defense in this case is a court offense. And this is the trampoline to this default. If they don't do this and that, then we may choose to go to court. We don't necessarily say we will go to court. So chances are, maybe they'll stop. And they'll say, you know what? We don't really want to mess up with this guy, with this gal. So how much would it cost us to run a suit? How much do we owe him? And maybe they'll come back with a counteroffer. Say, well, we agree based on these errors and whatever. You know, these agents are poor, poor bastards. And they can't afford this. But it looks like you're claiming that for years so-and-so and their injuries, we owed you $7,000 for that year and all that. Okay, how about, would you consider settling for $50,000? No. We haven't seen that yet. But it's not impossible. Because if you look at what we're claiming here, by the time we're done with injuries and damages, just to give you an idea of the power of this, of the damage in this process, is where did we have those numbers? 100,000, 200,000? By the way, in this case, they would add up to about 270,000 in special damages, 270,000 automatically in general damages, and punitive damages up to five times that amount. And you will settle for three times punitive damages when judgment passes. You're generous. You don't want to hurt them too badly for a little short of $700,000. That's where we stand. And I need to wake up Bill because he needs to take over from this point on. Yes, questions? I'll answer, sure.
Yeah, I know this is for one single person.
Yeah, we need a microphone.
Can it apply for husband and wife?
Just one second. Yes, say that again.
I said I noticed this is for Ima.
Yes.
One single person who's the FTV.
Yeah, wait a minute.
For
yes.
Husband and wife.
Yes, then would be Ima Ehima.
So we can have a husband and wife in one form.
Well, they could be...
one letter.
How about Wima Hart? would that work? Yeah, it can be if you're going at it together. Yeah, Wima Hurt is a good. Should we? I think that's. Let's.
I kind of can answer that.
Let's copyright that.
Yeah.
Yes.
We'll copyright. That's a good idea.
Let's copyright that.
Seriously, the when you write your papers, the rules of good writing in English apply. So you have to, if for example, if you're going to write your entire notice and demand in the third person, be consistent all the way through. Or you can write it in the first person, but be consistent. Don't switch. This is an exercise, frankly, in good writing. And it may not be... It may not be... very effective if you're switching styles. So whatever your style is, be consistent all the way through. And of course, the obvious, you know, the spelling should be correct and so forth. But it's amazing. I've seen some pretty terrible stuff that people put out where the spellings, the misuse of words, the using of then for than, you know, and stuff like that. And that all works against you because remember this, that the legal process is part law and part psychological warfare. So, for example, when I'm writing papers, you size up the enemy. What are they like? And you might look up the dossier of the judge and see what he's like. You know, I'm working with a judge now that... reversed a $6 million judgment that was decided by a jury. He overrode the jury. And that was my sign that this is the guy that I'm going to have to use muscle on. Okay? Pardon? Well, one of the things I did is I just put his name in on Google. Okay? And there are newspaper articles about him popped up. And I find that this guy is he's a Hitler, you know, in some respects. He disrespected it. Well, but that gave me a warning because I know what I'm dealing with. And so I made sure my paperwork is set up so that I'm extra careful with this guy, okay? And I'm in the middle of the battle right now, so I haven't done anything significant except issue maybe a writ of error. That's about it. But we're progressing. But you have to have good appearance, good format. Look at the customary formats in legal papers. You know, you can always go down to the clerk's office and just pick a case at random, pull it out, and look and see how they did it. You know, there's and of course it helps to kind of back off conceptually, just back off and get an overview. You know, what is a motion? Well, a motion is nothing more than a letter to the court asking for a favor. That's all it is. You want the court to make a decision. But a motion has a specific format. Okay? A business letter has a specific format. When I went to school, they taught us, well, here's how you write a business letter, here's how you write a personal letter, and where you put the address and whether you have block style or indented style and stuff like that. Well, that applies to legal writing. You have styles in writing, and you should have a style and then be consistent throughout doing it. So what was the question I was trying to answer now, if any? why be consistent?
You're talking about language and writing the
text
you wrote.
I'm hurt, he's hurt.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, basically, you can work in groups. You know, you can be husband and wife or a whole family or a whole community if that's what it calls for. But one thing about common law is that you don't have class action suits. That's an equity concept. Now, what?
You don't have motions either, do you? You don't put in motions in common law.
Well, you can make motions as a group. Yeah, everybody could sign the motion, but understand that even though you're a group of plaintiffs or defendants, whatever you are, you're still on an individual basis with common law. So I prefer to be a lone wolf and just, act on my own. It's nice to cooperate, maybe have a couple of cases. My suggestion is that if you're a husband and wife team, that you sue separately. It makes it easier for you if there are differences that crop up. You can move on and do what you want, and yet you can still cooperate fully if you're together.
Did you do that simultaneously or wait to be able to correct it the second?
Well, that's a strategy question, not a legal question, you see. And that's the psychological warfare part of it. When if I issue a writ of error, a lot of times I'll put writ of error, quae quorum nobis resident. Okay? That's a nice little phrase I found buried deep in a dictionary somewhere that they would never find. Okay? But when they see that, where did that come from? You know, and there's a certain amount of intimidation as they try to figure out what this particular writ of error is about. Other times I might just say writ of error. Or I might say writ of error quorum nobis. And then sometimes I identify myself when I'm signing an order. I'll identify myself as a private attorney. But other times I might identify myself as attorneys privatus, which is Latin for private attorney. What determines what I use? Well, I'm kind of sizing up the opposition. How easy is it to intimidate them? You know? And so it's a gamesmanship, and it's a battle of words, and it's a battle of definitions of words. So, you know, you have arguments with people who are picky about words. Well, it turns out it's very important what the meaning of is. Okay? Yes, sir.
Bill, you mentioned making a motion to the court. If you're the court in a common law suit and you put a motion in to the magistrate, does that put you in his jurisdiction? And then have you accepted de facto court?
Well, first of all, you're not putting in a motion to the magistrate. You're putting it into the court. You have to remember what hat you're wearing, okay? If you're going to be the plaintiff, you talk, think, and act like a plaintiff. So you would make a motion. And when I make a motion, I might ask for the moon. Of course, I try to look reasonable, you know, but I'll ask for the moon. And because I'm in there pitching, I want the court to decide in my favor. But when I take off my plaintiff hat and I put on my tribunal hat, you know, they've answered and we're through that part of the paperwork. Then what I'll do is when I put my tribunal hat in, I throw away my attitude. I now try to go right down the center of the road, neutral, make a decision as if I were making a decision in somebody else's case, if I were a judge. Because because that's an entirely different position of responsibility. And remember, what's the basic definition of a court? You remember? No. It's a stage, right. It's a stage upon which you put a show to show the world that you're right in your decision. You put on a bad show, you're not going to get the cooperation you want. Okay?
So follow up.
Okay.
So then once that motion is submitted to the clerk as the plaintiff,
right,
then you as the sovereign, as the judge,
right,
make a decision on that.
That's right.
And you don't ask the magistrate to make a decision.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Right. He can't make a decision in a court of record.
That's what I meant by
okay, court. You had a question back here.
That was my question.
You sure.
You're serving yourself.
Well, yeah, you have a certain amount of schizophrenia here. You know, that's exactly right. You have to understand what role you're playing. You are the king, and the court is defined as the person and the suit of the sovereign. But it also, more important than that legal definition, is the definition that says it's a stage upon which you put a show. And if you go to the website, that particular concept is fully described, why it's a stage, how it's a stage, and how it works. You'll look on the website, you have where it talks about a court, and then after that it talks about a court of record. Okay, a court of record is a specific format. Whereas a court, the whole generic definition of a court is, in fact, generic. It's all-encompassing what's a court about. You know, you're relying on people cooperating. Yes, sir.
How do you know that
Microphone?
The judge.
Start the question over, please.
A lot of judges in Orange County like to do tentative rulings.
Only if they have authority to make rulings, okay, which they don't have in a court of record. And if they do, you're going to bounce them out with a writ of error.
What if their tentative ruling states, because I did a motion and he just basically accepted it, you know?
Well, look, if you're in a court not of record, sure, he's going to take command. That's what they
but
do.
But what if, okay, so he basically accepted the motion I made.
You know, was he ruled in your favor?
Yeah, it was.
Are you in a court of record or not?
Yes, because
you are.
Yeah.
Okay, you can't do that. What you do is you do a writ of error. You get rid of that, even if it's in your favor, because you don't want a precedent of him making decisions in your court. You can turn around and reissue the order under your own authority.
Okay, even if I signed and sealed the order, I go ahead and do a writ of error and issue another order.
No. Wait a minute. You said you signed and sealed it. That's not him making the decision. That's you making the decision.
I've studied your website back and forth, and you know. Yeah. So I basically used your procedure how to do a motion. I did the whole, and I submitted.
Sure.
When the tentative ruling came in, he accepted.
Yeah, that's fine, but he's not authorized to.
Exactly, that's why I'm
asking. He cannot make a decision.
So then from there, what I do? I just do a writ of error.
Right.
Canceling his...
That's correct.
And that's it?
No.
That's why I'm asking what comes afterwards, because I haven't...
Well, you confused the issue because you were telling me you issued an order and so forth. Let me just lay out the steps, okay? Step one is you make a motion.
Right.
Step two, they answer it. Step three, if you wish, you can reply to the answer. Mm-hmm. Now, everybody's had their full and fair opportunity to state their point of view on those three sets of papers. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now it becomes the court's turn. If the court wishes, the court can have a hearing, but you don't have to have a hearing. Okay? Because the only purpose of a hearing is to clarify something that the court does not understand. So if you understand it all, then there's no need for a hearing. Okay? Now, some attorneys like to use that as a springboard to kind of somehow sneak more evidence in. But that's not what a hearing's for. You already had your chance to put your information in, whichever side you're on. Now it's the court's turn. Now, here it is, the court's turn, and what happens? The judge jumps in and he says, I decide in the motion maker's favor.
Object.
Well, yeah, you object. You can't do that. It's a court of record, and the tribunal is independent of the magistrate. So that means the magistrate cannot make any tribunal decisions.
Okay, because I even submitted a...
Not that, there's more. Okay, so now, after you've bounced him out, you have an open motion with no decision. Okay? He tried to make a decision. He claimed he made a decision. He may have even filed it in. But with the writ of error, you canceled it. Now you have a decision, or you have a motion that is undecided. Right? Because you rescinded the decision. Rescinded means it's no good right from the beginning. Nunc pro tunc, if you like technical language. All right? So what are you going to do with this open motion? You have to rule on it. The court has to rule on it, right? And the judge is not the court. So you rule on it.
Well,
you make your ruling. That's after you do the writ of error.
Oh, I submitted everything, even the order.
No, you don't do that. If you're going to make a motion and submit an order at the same time,
I told them they had 20 days to be able to answer, if not the order.
On an order to show cause.
Yeah. And
okay.
I told them they had 20 days to show,
fine,
you know, why it wouldn't,
okay,
you know, it,
well,
it
yeah,
wouldn't stand. And nobody
okay
ever answered.
Well, then what's the problem?
Then the, you know.
Sure.
The judge on top of that said, you know, because then we had, the tentative ruling, then the hearing came a week later, and he said,
look,
well, I accept your motion.
I'm getting the feeling that you actually believe the judge.
No, I'm asking.
You're acting like it.
Look,
let me shut this down a moment here, okay? I'm going to override you a little bit here, maybe a whole lot, but, you know.
No, I'm just asking what comes after. So now I do the writ of error, and I don't have to submit anything else because I already submitted my order.
No, you do have to do something else. You have to rule on the motion.
Again.
If you pre-ruled, if you went ahead and issued a ruling, well, okay, the ruling's there. And if they didn't object, it sticks. But normally, if there's no emergency, you make your motion, you let them answer, and then you reply to the answer if you wish. You don't have to. And then you make the ruling. I mean, if you're going to make a ruling, what have you done? You laid all your cards on the table, didn't you? And now they know how to answer it.
Nobody answered, you know.
Well, I understand that.
60 days have passed, and I'm like, so that's why I'm asking. I can just state in the writ of error that the ruling and the order submitted such date stands.
You could say that. And the reason is because they did not answer. And besides, the ruling that the judge made was not valid anyway. Not because it was a bad order. It's not valid because he has no authority to issue it.
Oh, okay.
Did you say that?
I understand.
Sure. Yeah, he's not authorized to make any decisions whatsoever.
What is he authorized to do in a court of record? What is the magistrate?
The magistrate is authorized to obey all orders of the court. Who's the court? Okay, so if you issue an order, he's obligated to obey it. However, don't confuse that with slavery, okay? Because we've outlawed slavery. He does not have to do what you tell him. He could quit his job instead. Okay?
That's right.
Yeah. Right, but you have no authority to enslave him. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
Do
So what happens when you issue the writ?
And what happens when
in the clerk of the court?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happens when you issue the writs and the clerk of the court rejects those writs three times?
Well, first of all, if the clerk is rejecting the writ, the first thing I would do is make a phone call to the clerk and just get an informal, not a formal, but an informal idea of why the clerk rejected it. And usually they put on a piece of paper why it is, okay? But what the truth may be, if you just talk nicely with the clerk, you may find out that the clerk was told by the judge to reject your paperwork, okay? Now that tells me who I really have to blame, okay? Because I don't like to sue the clerks because I know most of the time the clerks are just trying to do their job. They're not, they have no agenda, not normally. They're set up there, but their job careers depend upon the judges. So the judges have an undue influence over the clerks. So I'll just kind of check informally to find out what's going on. Now, that's not sufficient as evidence, but now I can put together if it's in fact a judge that's the problem, I can then put together a contempt proceeding where I accuse the judge of interfering with court process, that he's obstructing the court process, and then he has a chance to say, no, it wasn't me, the clerk acted on her own, or something, okay? Whatever happens. But you give them, due process is an important concept, and it applies to them as well as to ourselves. So if the judge is interfering, and by the way, on the website, there's that case involving a bicycle, where that's exactly what happened. The judge was behind it. The judge told the clerk to enter in an application to have the papers removed, rejected. So the clerk did that, and then he turns around and he rules on it. Well, we brought both him and the clerk in on contempt charges, okay? Now remember, this is the plaintiff pushing for contempt, right? So he's in slash and burn mode. Now, after everybody had a chance to reply, which, by the way, they didn't, but everybody had a chance to, then we took off the plaintiff hat, and now he put on his tribunal hat, and he went down the center of the road and made a ruling. And what he ruled was based on the evidence submitted. He ruled that the judge had undue influence on the clerk, and the clerk could not properly be held responsible for doing this, and therefore found the clerk not guilty of contempt, okay, and found the judge completely culpable, okay? So you see there was a difference in attitude. Here I'm, not me, but I mean, the plaintiff was out to kill, okay, demanding maximum punishment, and then but when he put the tribunal hat on, he says, "Well, wait a minute, what's really going on here?" Okay.
You didn't order a psych thing on yourself?
No. Well, it wasn't my case anyway, but I was helping on it.
Well, then
but that's
what happened then. So did the judge recuse himself or get a new judge?
Well, neither. What happened was that presiding judge reassigned that judge to Timbuktu, off in the corner of the county, taking him off of about 900 other cases, as well as ours, and brought in a new judge. So we looked up the dossier of the new judge. Go down to the law library, they have him there. And we found out that the new judge was not just a new judge. He was actually he had been a past presiding judge of the appellate department of the Superior Court, which meant that he was really a sharp cookie. He knew process. I mean, they write decisions that other courts rely on, okay? They set precedent. So this guy was highly qualified to be a judge, and yet they're just pretending, oh, this is just administrative change. No, what it is they were bringing in their top gun to deal with our case. All right? And the other thing that we found out by reading his dossier was that he was a member of a group of judges that loved the common law, and they met and studied it.
Wow,
you see? So here we've got the highest qualified judge on a superior court level, somebody who could be in the appellate courts, okay? And secondly, a specialist in common law. I don't think that was an accident that he showed up. All right? It didn't do any good, by the way, because tribunal, he couldn't be a tribunal. And it was a court of record.
Magistrate.
Yeah, he's a magistrate. So, but it was nice. It made it easier to deal with him because he understood what we said when we said it to him, as opposed to the prior judge who had some experience with common law people, you know, and was able to successfully handle him, but he couldn't this time because he met his match.
Did he do any procedure stuff?
Yeah, there was some more stuff that happened, but all I can say about it is that things went easier because we were dealing with an educated person now who did know the common law.
Yes. Hi. This question goes back to the actual notice of demand here. And this may be a strategy question more than anything. At the end, you have the list of demands that you're going mm-hmm. for. And maybe this is something for Mark to address more. My question is, why would you not ask for more declaratory-type relief at the very end? In other words, why couldn't you, instead of just saying my account is closed, and I'm not sure whether account being closed does that mean the previous accounts for the years that were in dispute, or does that mean going forward as well? Because couldn't you ask for declaratory relief in the sense that I am a non-taxpayer? And if the state of California were to actually issue such a thing, and it was regarding federal taxes, because that's where they claim they get their jurisdiction, wouldn't you then also have that same relief federally? That if the state of California said you're a non-taxpayer for federal tax purposes, then wouldn't you be a non-taxpayer under IRS?
Well, first of all, you're confusing the administrative process with the court process. If you want declaratory relief, you go to a lawsuit. This is the first step. You're not asking for declaratory relief. What you're doing is establishing your position and maybe scaring them enough to back off. Okay, so we're slamming them with a lot of case law, and we're hoping their attorneys are astute enough to read it and advise their client to back off. Okay? Now, if you want declaratory relief, in other words, you actually want a decision as to what the relative status is of the parties, then you go to a lawsuit because you're asking for a court judgment.
So the FTB, you're saying, couldn't make that decision?
No, that's just an administrative outfit. They're doing whatever they're doing, but it has no precedent. It's not res judicata. In other words, you're not getting a decision from them that now you can hold them to it in the future. They could stir up the pot a second time and start the process all over. But if you were to go to a court and get an actual court order stating, you know, a declaratory judgment out of a court, now you've got res judicata. In other words, you can bind them to it.
But if you didn't put it in the notice on demand, you could still add it at the time that. But it looks like the notice and demand pretty much can go right in, and that's your law. That's your common law lawsuit.
Well, that's right. That's the first 6 points fit very nicely into what's required for an action. So sure, you can put on the law, all the case law, just like the same in both in the case law. I mean, in the suit itself or in a notice and demand. It's the points 7 and 8 that are unique to a notice and demand. All right, but once you do that. Then you've got that notice and demand in, and they fail to do what they're supposed to do or what you're demanding they do, then you're going to do exactly what you said you'd do in number 8, which is you're going to defend yourself, right?
Okay, but let I mean, because there is a default provision in the notice and demand.
Yeah, but the default position is an administrative default. Now, it's possible that you could take that and run with it in the commercial law area, okay? But understand, that's commercial law, not common law. So the UCC-1 can be very useful in showing that you made the demand, they defaulted, and now you have a public hold on them, okay, through the UCC-1. But that's all statutory. So if you want to really take it further, you could actually sue them and get a judgment and now enforce the judgment. I've always felt the best tax return was a judgment, ordering them to pay. Okay. Yes.
I think that what you would like to hear.
I think. Oh, here's the mic. You have to use the guest mic.
I think that what you're attempting to suggest that maybe we should put something where the franchise tax board would say, okay, you're hereby forever forgiven from paying taxes or anything. We acquiesce. The IRS, you don't owe anything. However, that will not be binding. Whereas if you buy that lie, they can still come back at you. Whereas where we leave them, we may sue. And they either keep on harassing or stop, return the funds or not, and then we decide what we have to do. Or they totally don't do anything else. They never address anything else, which I think most of us would be happy to stop right there. We don't really want to have to go to court. Am I correct?
Well,
most of us.
You have return coming.
Okay. Now, however, if you do have returns coming, you do have money, if they don't make you a deal, now, if they do make you a deal, wouldn't that be acquiescing? They would acquiesce. So that's a pretty much an automatic, and I doubt they'll ever bother you afterwards because they know what they'll be coming up against. Right? Does that come closer?
Yeah, I just was asking whether if you did put it in the notice of demand, could you then add another demand if you actually did go to court? In other words, you're not limited by what's in the notice and demand as your remedies.
Right. No,
you go to court.
You could add more, but it would be somewhat impolite.
Well, that's why I'm asking. Wouldn't you then want to put, throw everything you'd like to get at?
Well, if you're going to be an honor, you want. I prefer to do the golden rule, which is, treat others the way you'd like to be treated if somebody had a claim against you. And so if these, you make your claim against them, you wouldn't want, if you were on the receiving end, you would not want trial by surprise, okay? You'd want to have a fair opportunity to answer. Now, there's this is a strategy decision, not a law decision, but you do make your demand, and if they refuse to respond, you could bring in probably smaller facts. You did your major facts in your notice and demand, but then when you realize that these guys are simply not cooperating, they're totally dishonoring you, well then, yeah, you could throw the book at them. You could bring in everything, but you would follow the same theme. You see? This comes down to good writing. No, and good composition. So can you rationally explain what it is that you're demanding of them and not only rationally but with authority? And if they fail to respond, well, yeah, you could add more stuff, but I don't think it's good technique to have surprise attacks. More questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Do I have the floor? Yeah. I am.
Own the floor.
I was just talking to a guy in the men's room. Oh, sorry, that's something else.
Yes.
I've been doing this.
Not so close. Back off.
I've been doing this for about seven.
Back off.
More?
There you go.
Is that better?
You're much better.
I've been doing this for about 17 years. None of this common law stuff. But you mean to tell me that you can empower your own court and you have the unfair advantage of being, say, the plaintiff and the judge?
What do you mean unfair?
Well,
you have the capacity to be fair, for one thing. But on the other hand, there's this old saying that no man should be judge of his own cause.
No.
I understand that, but you're not a man.
Right.
You're a king. That's different.
Uh-huh.
Now, I can give you an everyday example And when I go in, I have, well, first of all, there's legal reasons, which I can give you. But in, if we want to talk a little bit about the morality of it, what are we doing here that you don't see every day in traffic court? I mean, who's the accuser? It's the state, right?
Right.
Okay, who's the judge? The state. And who executes the judgment? It's the state. All right? Where's the fairness there? That's why we have a court of record. Because a court of record, if they did it their jobs right, the judge wouldn't make any decision. You would get a fair decision out of the tribunal. And remember that what makes the system fair is the fact that any time the defendant wants, he can call in a jury. That's what makes it fair. Okay? So you call in a... And then the jury of sovereigns, I'm talking about the ideal system, the jury of sovereigns takes over the court. The 12 sovereigns set the plaintiff sovereign to one side, and they run the court. Here's a way to understand it. Let's say, put your mind back to the 12th century when you had a king and noblemen, and the king had his army and each of the noblemen had their own private armies, okay? So now a little disagreement develops between two noblemen. Well, one way to do it is just send their armies out in the field and duke it out that way, and whoever wins gets to own the other guy's castle, okay? That's one way to handle it. But the noblemen were not stupid. I know there were some stupid ones, but I mean, basically, they had intelligence and education and understanding and philosophy and so forth. And so they developed a system where a nobleman could call on 12 other noblemen, bring them in, and have them listen to what's going on. And when these 12 noblemen made a unanimous decision, you now had 13 armies against one army. And that generally brought peace in the realm. Okay? That's the practical side of it. Well, the juries were very well respected. And you can see why. And so this passed down. We've inherited through our culture a high respect for juries. So?
Well, it's... am I all right here?
Yeah, you're fine.
And so I'm just bawled over that I've never heard of this before, and it has such power.
You're not supposed to.
Oh.
You're not supposed to hear it before.
Now, could you represent me in a situation, and or could I, as establishing, could I establish a court of record and for in the behalf of someone else?
The only time that I know that you can do that and be accepted is with a habeas corpus. You see, in a habeas corpus, somebody has grabbed the king and incapacitated him, so a friend can come along and on his own...
And act in his behalf.
Well, not necessarily in his behalf, but at least move for habeas corpus and open up his court of record and pass judgment on it, because you might decide you don't want to let him out. Okay. Maybe he really did do something.
So essentially, yeah. Each and every one of us here who want to embrace this technology, mm-hmm. if you will, mm-hmm. we will open up our own courts of records
yes.
for our own
yes.
matters.
Right. Now, let me... do we have access to the website?
Yes. Wow. Right there. Hold on.
Okay.
Let me take care of that. Your,
So, the... Let's see.
Do you have anything new now, or do you want me to get on?
Do we have more to cover here?
No.
Okay,
we're done with the notice and demand.
Oh, we're done with the notice and demand.
Yes, but do you want to go on the internet, or do you want me to go on the files?
If you have the website on, it's fine. I don't need the internet if you have the website loaded.
Keep them busy.
So, okay, I'll keep them distracted here.
I have a real quick question.
Okay, who wants to ask?
I have a real quick question.
Oh, yes, sir.
If you realize that they have no authority to get these taxes from you for all these past years, why
sure.
wouldn't you ask for all your money back, for all the money you've been paying for the last 30 years?
Well, it depends on how much you want to do battle. You could, but do you really want to fight the issue? You know, a lot of times you can do a compromise, not necessarily a fair compromise, but at least you do a compromise, you get them off your back and they leave you alone. You know, I know one guy who did a year in jail, or, you know, he was actually in prison for non-payment of taxes. And the judge, when they went to let him out, he told them he was going to burn every receipt. He wasn't ever going to file taxes again. And they told him to be on probation, and he said, screw you. He says, this is where I'm going to be on the date you think I should report. If you want me, you come and get me. But I'm not going out of my way to your place. And he made it absolutely clear that they were getting nowhere with him, you know. And so they left him alone. He hasn't heard from him, I guess, in 10 years, you know. They left him alone.
But this is mostly matters of civil stuff. It's certainly not criminal, right?
The same.
He was in jail for a year.
No, but
that's,
I'm saying,
pretty good.
We establish our courts of records to settle non-criminal kinds of stuff. Is that correct?
Well, no. Well, you do a counterclaim. You open up your court of record as a counterclaim to what they're doing, and you challenge the jurisdiction. By what authority do they presume to rebel against the sovereignty of the state? You're the sovereignty of the state.
No, but the smoking gun. They caught me with the gun in my hand. There were 10 witnesses. I shot.
Oh, well, then that's easy. We just go to a common... If you want to push it to the limit, you go to a common law grand jury, and they indict you, and you're on your way to a jail.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, that's because they say that when you have a trial with a judge, that's a trial by the government. You got that? If you have a trial with a judge, you have a trial by the government. But if you have a trial with a jury, you have a trial by the people. Okay? So, but let me show you something here. We'll go to... Here we go. And we'll go to reference law books. Okay. You know what? We may need, Mark. I think we do need access to the internet. This won't. The link goes to the internet. So, boy, he's got a secret weapon he pulled out. But
my sovereign sword.
But anyway, the California Constitution, Article 6, Section 1. Specifically mandates that all the courts in California are courts of record. Okay? So, you got the highest authority, and even if it's not the highest authority, everybody agrees it is. Okay? And you have the unlimited power to contract in your sovereign capacity. And so what they do is they get you to agree to proceed in a court not of record. And that's what all these criminal courts are. That's what the civil courts are. Those are all courts not of record. So, and if you agree to it, then the judge does what he does and so forth, because that's how that system works. Now, they trick you into it. And the trick is that they take advantage of your lack of knowledge. Okay? And so here's how it happens. You go to a criminal court, okay, on some charge. At that point, the cop is acting on his own. He arrested you not as a representative of government, but on his own authority. That's what every arrest is. So then they get you to court and they say, Mr. So-and-so, you are accused of violating code section so-and-so. How do you plead? Guilty, not guilty, or no contest? Well, no matter which one of the three you choose, you are agreeing to the code. And you're contracting right there. And as soon as you put your pleading in, you're on your way to an alternative court. Okay? You're out of the court of record. Up until that point, it was common law. So, now, if you didn't agree, if instead you said, I object to the whole system, I'm in my sovereign capacity, I do not yield my sovereignty, and what's your authority? Well, they can't show it. So that kind of binds them. And the only way they can do, if they do want to prosecute, they're going to have to go to a grand jury and get an indictment. Okay? And have the people prosecute you instead of the government prosecute you. Now, when they go to the grand jury and they say, this guy did so-and-so, he broke these rules and so forth, and we want you to indict him. And remember, there's no limits on the jury. They can indict for anything. Okay? So, right. And so they produce the indictment, and now in the full formal system, you would next go to the petite jury. And they have standards there of evidence and so forth, and the government obviously is involved in it, but it's a prosecution by the people. Whereas if you instead of an indictment, you had an information. Prosecutor or somebody goes to and presents an information to the judge. The judge plays like a grand jury of one, and he decides whether or not this is a good information. If it looks like good information, they prosecute. But you can object to that. You can insist on a grand jury indictment. Unfortunately, the grand juries have so little knowledge about their jobs that, you know, it's almost a rubber stamp operation. But nevertheless, that's the theory of it. Okay.
In traffic court, and you can just say, I don't agree to this? Object.
Well, they're going to override you. You know, they're going to ignore you because they're going to test your knowledge. But, you know, if they do that, well, then you go ahead and do your counterclaim. You sue them because they overstepped their jurisdiction.
What about a jury of your peers?
Well, first of all, what is a peer?
Somebody like Joe Sovereign?
No. A peer is somebody who's a member of the peerage. Peerage. P-E-E-R-A-G-E. He's a member of the peerage. What is the peerage? That's the nobility. And higher. Nobility and higher, which would also be the sovereigns. Okay? So a jury of peers does not mean a jury of equals, although everybody thinks so. The reason there's a confusion of terms is because in a jury of peers, well, when we broke away from England, everybody became equal. Everybody became a sovereign. So we were automatically members of the peerage. So you had a jury of your fellow sovereigns, or the members of the peerage. Anyway, here's the state constitution, okay? And the state constitution says, I think, let's see, where is it?
I put something in the search. This is 1789.
No, it's supposed to... here it is. Right. Okay, we go down to Article 6. And Section 1 says... The judicial power of this state is vested in the Supreme Court, Courts of Appeal, and Superior Courts, all of which are courts of record. Okay? Where is there any authority to do otherwise? Okay? If you're in the judicial branch, this is mandated. Okay? This is not maybe. It's saying they are courts of record. So what's going on here? Well, here's what's going on. The statutes and codes, who created those? The legislature. What about the separation of powers doctrine? Okay? So what's happened is the legislature created the statutes and codes. The administrative branch created its code of regulations. Okay? Regulations for there. And the regulations have to do with how to implement the statutes and codes. So when you have a court proceeding as a court not of record, using statutes and codes, what has happened is that the whole court is shifted over into the executive branch. They're being paid out of the judicial budget, but they're actually sitting in an administrative capacity. And so these codes are all administrative. The only thing that works legitimately, if you're going to be perfectly legitimate, the only thing that works is to have a court of record, and that's the only judicial function that's authorized. Okay? And if we go back here and we click on court of record, we find out that a court of record is proceeding according to the common law. That means no statutes. Okay? So it's all administrative procedure. And?
If no statutes, that means all the penal codes are out the window.
Yeah, that's all administrative stuff.
So this
contract.
This is the best way to beat a traffic ticket.
Yeah.
Tougher for
them. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what some people do. They go in, they refuse to plead, and they challenge jurisdiction. Where's your authority? Now, you don't say, hey, you can't prosecute me because this is not a court of record. Well, they say, okay, we'll fix that.
Oh, boy.
And then they put you in jail. Okay. But if you just say, I don't see the jurisdiction, what is your jurisdiction? Now the burden shifts to them to prove it. They have to prove their jurisdiction. So, and you don't tell them, you don't educate them, you let them bumble along. And then when they fail to produce, that's when you do a counterclaim, that's when you tackle them. Yes, sir?
I did that at arraignment.
We have a mic here somewhere.
I had this problem. And at arraignment, I said, I'm not pleading. I said, you have no jurisdiction.
Right.
And the judge told me, he said, we don't see it that way.
That's
four
right.
Four times he told me that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. They walked out, I walked out.
Yeah. They didn't enforce it, did they?
Yeah, they kind of did. I had more court dates coming up.
Oh, okay. So they went and set a court date anyway.
Yes.
Okay. Well, see, you have to... You have to apply the old football rule. You know, you familiar with that one? What's the best defense?
A good offense.
There you go.
What are you doing?
So, a best defense is a good offense. And so, the football rule applies to law. So you have to become very offensive. And the method is called counterclaim. You do a counterclaim. You are suing them. You name their court as a defendant. And you name the cop as a defendant if you wish. Again, if I generally like to keep it on a low level. But if necessary, I will sue the state the first go around. It's a strategy question, okay? And so, but you counterclaim, you say, what's your jurisdiction? And this time they have to prove it to your court. Now, they're going to try and ignore you anyway. So sometimes you have to get tougher with them. Now, normally in 95% of the cases, when you do a writ of error where you reversed his decision, because up until that point they didn't really take you seriously, but you issue a writ of error, and in your writ of error you have a little educational course that explains why it is that you can do this. You educate them because they've never seen anybody come in with law before. And so then, and after they read it, 95% of the judges play ball. But 5% don't. 5% go for it a second time. And those are the ones that I will fine for contempt of court. Now, in all this time that I, with my experience, only once have I had to go to the third step. And actually, it was longer than three steps. I built a series of contempts against this judge because he was Hitler reincarnated on the bench. You know? Yeah. And so what I did is I issued a bench warrant for his arrest. You know, and basically, I wasn't trying to get him arrested, but what I did is I instructed the sheriff to approach the judge with one of the other orders that had been issued before and get from the judge a promise. That's all very simple. Just get a promise that he would obey this order now. And if the judge refused to promise, he was to take him into custody and hold him until he did promise. Okay? And I put in all the reasons to show the sheriff that he had the authority to do this. You had to, you know, you have to explain it. And on the website, we have the actual bench warrant, so you can see it. So you go to 1215.org/Q, and there you'll see it. You'll see it's not complete, but it has examples showing the different aspects. So you can see a counterclaim against a criminal case. The criminal case that where we did the counterclaim involved four felony charges. Okay, it was actually the first serious case that I was ever involved in. I mean, we'd done traffic tickets and, you know, low-level stuff, but here they were out for blood. They wanted to put that person away, and they brought four felony charges. Okay.
What were the nature of the charges?
Bad checks. Okay.
What was it?
Bad checks.
What were the?
But the individual wasn't intending to pass bad checks. The person was trying to assert the bill of exchange thing and redemption and that sort of thing. So there was some integrity here, but they were out to kill. Okay, they wanted, and this individual was put into psychological observation three times, but she was tough, and she had a lot of outside support. She spent 470 some days in jail, and didn't put a pleading in.
She kept paying for her services with a bad check.
She kept challenging their jurisdiction. Show me your jurisdiction. She would not plead. Every time they wanted her to plead, she'd say, where's your jurisdiction? And after they spent too much time playing that game, she did a counterclaim. And she sued four judges, five prosecutors, and six public defenders, and some cops, and a few other people, 22 defendants in all. And so it was a tough fight. But it was the first genuine test of this concept, and it worked. I mean, it was a tough fight. She spent a lot of time, but it worked.
And you were a consultant?
Well, I was one of the team, yes. I wasn't everything, but I was a team.
Q,
lowercase q. Don't put in a capital Q. It won't work. But it's lowercase q. Mm-hmm.
I gave up too soon and pled guilty. Is there anything I can do now?
Yes. Sure. Yep. Sure. I told you earlier what to do. You forgot already.
You're out of here.
Yeah, you're out of here.
Counterclaim?
Who's the keeper of the gong? No, but let me answer that. Okay, what you do, to answer your question, seriously, you open up your court of record, which is a superior court, and you sue that court along with the parties because they were an inferior court. See, look here. Let me show you here. It might even be on this page. If we go down to the bottom. Nope, this is not it. Okay, let's back up. And okay. I think. Oh, here we go. Superior court versus inferior court. Okay? And you go to the bottom of that. Yeah, right?
I understand what you did, Bill.
Yeah, here it is. The judgment. Here we go. I guess I'm doing that.
You're backing up.
Is that what it is? Okay. Okay. It says here, the judgment of a court of record whose jurisdiction is final is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. This is the Supreme Court of the United States speaking. Okay. It is as conclusive on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the fact and by deciding it. And that was quoted, that was a prior case which was quoted as recently as 1973. A court of record outranks the Supreme Court. Okay? So you can go ahead and sue them. We have here, here we go. Notice this. The only inherent difference ordinarily recognized between superior and inferior courts is that there is a presumption in favor of the validity of the judgments of the superior court, none in favor of those of the inferior court. and that a superior court may be shown not to have had power to render a particular judgment by reference to its record. So the record can show that the superior court was actually an inferior court. And but when a court note, however, that in California, superior court is the name of a particular court. But when a court acts by virtue of a special statute conferring jurisdiction in a certain class of cases, it is a court of inferior or limited jurisdiction for the time being, no matter what its ordinary status may be. So we're talking about a special statute conferring jurisdiction in a certain class of cases. That's a fancy way of saying a criminal court, or a civil court, or a maritime court, or an admiralty court, or the court of the exchequer, or court of claims. See? Those are all inferior courts. Court of record's the only real court.
What about a court of justice?
Go ahead. Well, as a matter of fact, that, you know, the king's court needs entertainment, a little break once in a while.
You give us that.
Yes. Well, I didn't bring my jester's hat today. Yes.
Where's the record? I filed some papers, but there's no record that I know of any proceedings.
I'm so happy you asked that question. Okay, where is the record? All right. Let's go to, I believe it's in court of record. Okay. And it says right here, it keeps a record of the proceedings. All right. What is a record? The proceedings of the courts of common law are records, but every minute made by a clerk of a court for his own future guidance in making up his record is not a record.
There's nothing there. That's what I was thinking.
The common law record consists of the process, the pleadings, the verdict, and the judgment. After judgment, such errors were reviewable by writ of error, and so on. So basically, in a nutshell, a record is what was the proposal put before the court and what decision was made in response. So your docket sheet is the record so far as it covers those two points. The rest of it is just fluff, okay, as far as record goes. Remember this, that... Well, think of it this way. If you were an auto mechanic and somebody brought a car in for you to fix, would you call that person that came in your patient?
Fine.
No, because the doctors own the word patient, right? You would not call him a client either. Why? Because the attorneys own the word client. You call them a customer, right. And in the case of a court of record, only a court of record keeps records. Equity courts do not keep records. They keep something that looks like a record, but it's not a record. The court of record owns the word record. Okay? So the equity courts have to find some other term. So what do you see? When you go to court, you'll see... When you go there, you ask the clerk, you want to see the record. And what does she give you? She doesn't give you the record. What she gives you is a docket sheet. Or it's called Register of Actions. Or who knows what other names they give it. But they don't call it record. Because only a court of record keeps records. It's a little technicality. And people get sloppy, including attorneys and judges, and they refer to the record in a court of equity. Technically, it's inaccurate, but... Everybody knows what's meant, so. Yes.
You know my friend JB in Florida? He emails you all the time. He is dealing with a foreclosure where the judge came back a year later, even though he won his case with prejudice. Mm-hmm. And now he's filed a writ of error. They've ignored that. He wants to know, should he do an order to show cause for lack of standing and jurisdiction, or are you going to say go for contempt? Because this is one of the judges, this is one of the 5% that's ignoring the writ of error.
Yeah, well, bring him up for contempt.
Okay.
And if he ignores that, bring him up for contempt again. And if he ignores that, bring him up for contempt. Then he might try a bench warrant, or he might do something that's more fun, like sue him in a federal court okay, because this is supposed to be a republic, and in a republic you're supposed to have your sovereignty recognized, because that's the nature of a republic, and that's described in the website what a republic is. And so just sue the judge. And by the way, while you're suing the judge, you might as well put a hold on his personal property, like his house or something.
Okay.
And he may feel the pain of not having any credit. You know, and at some point, because you see, the judge has no control over the commercial system. And if you can legitimately, by court order, do something, well, you know, the commercial system may cooperate with you. File a UCC-1, for example. You know, we had a case here in California where some guy was really trying to pull a fast one, and he took over a house, claimed ownership of some kind, whatever, did some manipulations, and then he was trying to get a loan, and we filed a preservation of interest, and boy, when that hit, the lending company just backed right off. They did not make a loan. We clouded the title. Okay.
Okay, and then here in California, where we're dealing with California Civil Code on foreclosures, how are we supposed to do common law and not mention codes?
Codes are not common law. You can make up any law you want. You're the sovereign.
But we're citing what they violated, which overturns what they did.
Well, they may be obligated to it, but you're not. Okay, you had an expectation that they would obey the rules that they are dedicated to obeying. Okay, and because they broke their rules, they cause you an injury.
Right.
Okay, you're not obligated to the rules, but they are.
So what goes into the pleading that I'm just
that's
damaged?
What goes in that? Just what I said. You just list these rules. Hey, they're. What do we have in a notice and demand? Let's go back to that. Okay. What are the elements of a notice and demand? Well, let's see. Got to do this size thing. And okay, we have procedure, notice and demand. All right, and. Okay. The 6 points, all right? You say what it is he's doing. You tell him what your injuries are, like maybe you lost the house or whatever, you know, you're not getting the benefits of the lawsuit or whatever. And then you say he's got a duty not to cause you an injury. How did that duty come about? Well, he may be a citizen of the United States or a corporation, which is subject to the statutes. Okay? So there's his duty. And then he's breaching that duty. He's disobeying the very rules that he's supposed to be obeying. Just list them down. Make sense?
Yeah.
So what you're stating is, let's say a bank, right?
If you're stating most banks state their national associations, you know, if they're breaching the duty automatically because they're a national association, then, you know, they fall under every single statute and rule, you know, and title that has to do with the banking system.
Well, I don't really know that, but I can tell you this.
Would that be their duty? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I can tell you. Well, yeah, if they all corporations are creatures of the state. And in order to continue as a corporation, they have to obey the statutes and codes. Okay, and here on the web page, right on the home page, we have mortgage and foreclosure notes.
Yeah, I read it down
there. Okay, well, there's the rules. If you can read the rules and see where they disobeyed it, well, then you got a case.
Oh, I understand.
And you have to show an injury, of course. Okay, yes. We have 5 minutes. We have 4 minutes, actually.
You started.
Go ahead.
You started back with him. He was asking if somebody could do a habeas corpus for someone else and other judges that we can start with.
Yeah, habeas corpus can be used anywhere you have jurisdiction in question. And that includes civil cases as well as criminal cases.
Isn't criminal also civil?
Well, it's not common law. To me, there's only Oh, we got 8 minutes.
8 minutes.
Look, to me, there are only two kinds of law. There's common law and there's everything else. Okay? And common law beats everything. It trumps everything. That's why I like it. And it settles the issue. It's not appealable. Okay? And I'm sovereign.
So when we finish these processes like the notice and demand,
sure,
or like similarly the negative averment, we issue in that one, like you said on the other, a nihil dissent, judgment in nihil dissent. Is that not already a judgment that you need not to?
Well, I don't understand those fancy terms. I mean, I've read it in the dictionary what nihil dissent means, and I keep forgetting, you know.
It says nothing.
It's like quorum.
Yeah, well, you know, if he dishonored you by saying nothing, then you get default. If that's what you're talking about. I understand the word default.
But they also turn it into a foreign judgment. It's just a judgment.
Well, every judgment is a foreign judgment if you go to a different district.
Right,
you know, a different. Yeah. If you have a California judgment and you go to Florida, that's a foreign judgment.
Can you take that default to common law, win it there, and then...
Sure.
And then get a writ of execution or something?
Well, the state of California, for example, requires that all the courts be common law courts. That's what a court of record is.
Then if you win there, can you use the sheriff's
But sure.
You have to file a
common law case.
For everyone that's doing negative averments, if you win a negative averment and you by default and you take it to common law and you win there, can you use that as a writ of execution? Can you somehow create a writ of execution to get the sheriff's department to confiscate the property?
Okay. You have to deal with the definitions that are in these codes if you want to follow their procedures. Okay. And so if you want to avoid the courts,
right,
and you want to use pure administrative procedure, conceivably you could set things up in such a way that they get sucked into a judgment that's non-judicial. But if it is a judgment, even though it's non-judicial, there is a procedure in the civil code system where you can register that judgment with the clerk. And from that point on, they will enforce it like any judgment.
That
just look it up in the book. It's right there in the civil code.
The
code of civil procedure. It's right in there. You know, the thing, the code of civil procedure is arranged in a logical sequence. You can see how to start a suit, and it goes into how to serve. It goes into, it's all in sequence. So go to the part that deals with judgments. And it's pretty simple English, a lot of it.
Or elsewise, after the negative averment, where you got default, could you also, you said, you started off, when we get distracted so much, you start here, you said, and then you have a writ of error. Could you issue a writ of error with a writ of plevin?
The purpose of a writ of error is to correct an error in court procedure.
Right.
When a judge files an order into the court in a court of record, that was an error on the part of the clerk. The clerk should never have accepted an order from an unauthorized source.
Because he has no authority.
He has no authority to issue any orders. The tribunal must be independent of the magistrate in a court of record.
So then, like you said last time we went through this notice and demand, all this that we went through all day long, and all of these issues and all these points,
uh-huh,
we could throw all of that out, because that's just for all of us that don't believe that we could just walk in fresh and say, okay, I'm voiding your judgment with a writ of error because you have no
authority in Jersey. Well, let me deal with that. Let me deal with that. Okay? Let me deal with that. Let's go to law notes, the section on law notes, and we go to... let's go to court. What's the definition of a court? Okay. What does it say?
Where the state.
Do you think that would be a good maneuver to go in and do what you said?
Right from the scratch without having that done.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to pay attention to the world around you. The reason you have to pay attention is because those are the very same people you expect to enforce your orders. So when you're in China, I highly recommend that you present your case in Chinese, because they won't understand English. Okay? So when you go to, when you're in the system, you may have a judgment, but at the same time you have to pay attention to the muscle men, what they're expecting. And because otherwise they're not going to use their muscles in your behalf. We got 2 minutes.
Okay.
2 minutes. You have that 2 minutes.
So I have a question about federal district court and state superior court.
Okay.
Let's say that one of the courts issues a judgment and you're not satisfied with it because you later found out through the seminar that they were operating as an inferior court.
Yeah.
You would have to do a counterclaim and then...
No. No. Not, since it's a dead issue, it's no longer a counter. You're now doing a claim against them.
You have to do an original claim.
You're now
claim.
The plaintiff, sure. And you're suing them, and that court is a defendant.
So the district court, the judge, the company, whoever?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, you sue them. You name them all as defendants if you wish. That's a strategy decision, and it depends on how much work you want to do responding to their responses when you name them as plaintiffs. Okay.
We have 1 minute, maybe? Just a quick
maybe
one.
Maybe. Better.
All
okay.
Right. I'm doing work on the internet. I'm doing internet marketing, and as I approach for all these different companies, the magic $600 mark, they're insisting I give them a social security number.
Hey, look, they send 1099s in on me all the time.
Okay.
And if they decide to come after you, I think you just spent a whole day studying that issue.
Well, you slept through half of it, though, remember? In the beginning. We saw all of you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, how are we doing on time?
20 seconds. Yeah.
1 minute.
Another one.
I had a question. If you're kidding,
give him the mic.
Give him the mic.
If you're getting sued on a small claims court, how do you move it to... be able to do a counterclaim.
Yeah, do a counterclaim, and the amount of the counterclaim will exceed the authority of the small claims court. And, in fact, I would make it so large that it would go into the big claims. Forget the limited claims. Just go all the way, because you want unlimited authority for your court. And theoretically, you could run it in the small claims court, but the fact of the matter is that you have to deal with their psychology. Again, when in China, you know, talking Chinese.
Okay.
They want more money?
No, they have certain rules and customs how they operate in each level of court. So you kick it up into the unlimited ones. Okay, that's it for this. So have you cut it off yet?
Has everyone signed to get their free copy of this event? I think I missed a couple.
Okay, now we're off the...